Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines on cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. We have a great show lined up for you today as we're starting to see the dust settle after the election and new markets emerging. We're going to discuss some of the risk and opportunity involved. But first, our guest today, we've had the pleasure of working with as a sponsor of our special 2020 election report. He is one of the nation's leading cannabis law attorneys and was chosen by Law 360 as a 2020 MVP of the year in the cannabis category. He is a partner and helps lead the global cannabis group at Denton's Law Firm. Please welcome Eric Berlin.
Thank you, Heather. Thank you very much for inviting me. And it's a pleasure to be here with New Frontier Data.
Well, we're so happy to have you back. And our next guest is our in-house expert. He leads our amazing research team here at New Frontier Data. Please welcome our Chief Knowledge Officer, Mr. John Caguia. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Heather. I'm delighted to be back.
Good. Well, we have a lot to cover, so we're going to dive right in. MJ Biz Daily reported newly legal states offer marijuana growers fresh opportunities, but some are greener than others. So, Eric, I wanted to start with you. Given its the size and high population, New Jersey seems primed to take advantage of the recreational cannabis. What can we expect from New Jersey and its neighbors next year?
Well, this step with New Jersey is an important one. New Jersey is a small but very populous state. It's over 9 million. And then you think of its addressable market right there in the mid-Atlantic with so many states bordering it. It has a huge addressable market. So it's an important geography. Also, and there hasn't been much discussion about this, but if you look at the ballot initiatives in the past, New Jersey stands out as having a much lower tax rate than the other states, which I think is really important. New Jersey smartly recognize that having too high a tax rate just drives things to the illicit market. There's already a very robust illicit market in New Jersey and New York. I mean, in fact, in terms of just total cannabis sold on legal or illegal markets, New York is one of the biggest markets in the world. So that industry exists, and New Jersey is now making an attempt to bring it into the legal regulated market. And I think their lower tax rate will help on that. And then, of course, there is the domino effect. And I do believe New Jersey will have a very important domino effect on the other mid-Atlantic states. You already have New York affirmatively working to get there. Connecticut says that it will as well. Pennsylvania is a little bit tricky with its legislature. You certainly have the governor supporting legalization. You have a effective and significant advocate in the lieutenant governor, John Fetterman, but you don't have a legislature that it will be as easy to get through. And then I'll just say this, that's all very good news. And I do think we'll have a domino effect. There can be a chasm between bipartisan support of ending prohibition and a bipartisan agreement as to how to legalize and regulate. So as much as we sit back and say all of these states are primed to get it done next year, no, I certainly think there's a possibility that some of them won't, because it's easier said than done.
Right. John, what are your thoughts about this? I feel like Eric mentioned, it's really brings up New York coming online and being competitive with the tax rates.
Yeah, so first, just on what's happening in New Jersey. I saw an article this morning that said they finally reached an agreement on how cannabis would be regulated. And so there's a draft bill that they think is finally going to be able to determine the future of regulated cannabis in New Jersey. And to Eric's point, you know, this has been an issue that's been kicking around the New Jersey legislature for a while. And so it's taken them quite a while to reach consensus. For the jurisdictions that are just starting to have this debate now, it's going to get very thorny, and there's going to be, you know, some really complex issues to address around licensing. How many people get licenses? How big are how are those licenses governed? And how do they scale up? The kind of issues around access, issues around taxation regulation. New Jersey has had a head start because this issue has been bubbling for a little while. And to Eric's point about the lieutenant governor, he actually had an op-ed in the Washington Post yesterday basically saying, let's just get it done. Let's get legalization on a national basis should now occur. But for particularly the more conservative states, the Mississippi's, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Mississippi, South Dakota, potentially Montana, I think they are going to face some real kind of legislative deliberation that will protract the process. Now, coming back to New Jersey and its impact on New York and the surrounding states. So first, you know, Cuomo came out almost immediately after the election saying that they were going to push to get it done, which I think is a really promising sign. I say this often, but I think we are all underestimating the kind of consequence and reverberation of legalization in New York. It is a phenomenally kind of consequential market, not just for the sheer scale of it, but as the country's top tourism destination, the fact that New York is going to be the lens through which a lot of global kind of tourists, and indeed a lot of American tourists, see legal regulated cannabis for the first time, I think means that it's going to be really influential in exposing people to what regulated cannabis can be. Two, as the epicenter of kind of the country's financial markets, we're going to be seeing access to capital or capital deployments, I think, in a way that looks quite different than we have seen in other markets, even in big places like Illinois, which has its own substantial kind of financial markets. I think there's something about proximity to who has the money and where the money is getting deployed means that we might likely see a lot more kind of activist investors in some of these businesses, and potentially some investments in aspects of the industry that have been somewhat neglected, you know, opportunities around technology, in particular technology and innovation, that I think could be spurred by the access to the deep liquidity of New York's financial and capital markets. And then third, you know, to a certain extent, New York has been the epicenter of American cultural cool. Like the impact of this kind of intersection of legal cannabis and the extraordinarily vibrant creative economy in New York means that, you know, I think we are going to start seeing ways around how cannabis brands are built, how cannabis consumer engagement happens, that are going to be really, really interesting to see. And because of the density of population that you have in New York City in particular, you know, it's hard to predict all of the myriad ways this could manifest. But I think it's certainly going to be something that adds a lot of vibrancy and a huge level of dynamism to the emergence of cannabis on the East Coast.
Right. Well, moving on to another emerging market with South Dakota, I'd like to get your take on this because they're a little bit of a unique situation having legalized both medical and recreational. What challenges, Eric, do you feel like they're going to face most not being able to be in the position that, you know, New Jersey or Arizona were with already having medical framework in place?
Well, first of all, let's just acknowledge the amazing pivot that is from New York that does not have has not yet legalized cannabis to South Dakota, which has. And I bet most people 5 years ago didn't see that coming. So, and it is a far, in many ways, far less impactful result than what John is talking about as to when New York moves. And so acknowledging that as well, but it's really important that the people of South Dakota spoke here. Even when their elected officials were telling them to vote against this, they voted, and they voted, you know, fairly strongly. South Dakota got 69%, I think, for medical. The adult use was much closer, and I think that'll play a role, by the way. So it's important, and for purposes of having now senators that report to people of a state that have legalized, it's important. So I actually think in South Dakota, this is a very challenging situation. And it's challenging also in part because it's a very small market. So you're going to have limited number of folks who are going to allocate significant capital for advocacy there, right? I mean, there's only so much money in South Dakota for the medical market. How much are you going to spend to try to shape the market the way you want it to be shaped. So I think it's a very challenging situation, particularly when you have members of the state government openly hostile to the yeah. program and still kind of like denying what their constituents voted for. And in many ways, it's a similar and interesting situation with Mississippi. You have, again, government officials openly hostile to the ballot initiative when it was running against the ballot initiative when it was put up. The ballot initiative had this really odd procedure. And yet still, despite that, the state overwhelmingly voted for medical cannabis in Mississippi. And now after the fact, you still have people fighting it and fighting it with, apparently this is the new American way. If you don't get your way, you just litigate it forever. And that's what we're starting to see happen in Mississippi. So I think with states like that, that even though the people have spoken and you have significant support, where there is this government inertia in the other direction and worse, I do think it'll take time and it will be difficult to get those done. But the bottom line is, you know, those states are now in the fold and they're part of the count and it'll take time, but it'll happen eventually. And we've seen that in other states like Maine. Maine took forever to get their program up and running. And I just read this week that the number one agricultural crop in Maine now is cannabis. So these things take some time and they change. And in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter whether it takes a year or 3 years. It matters a lot to the patients who need the relief. And it's a serious thing and it's absolutely wrong to drag it out on them. But in the grand scheme of things, we're going to get there with all these states.
Yeah, it seems like New York is going to definitely have a bigger impact, but that was kind of more expected. I think South Dakota being, you know, any kind of marijuana laws passing in a red state is just encouraging for the nation, right?
We see this now in various red states, like Oklahoma is a really, I guess I'd say robust. It's a very open, I think is the right word, open medical market. It's pretty easy for someone in Oklahoma to access that market, and people don't have a problem with it. I mean, it's going just fine. It's just interesting to me that we could debate about what this election means, but I think most people recognize two things from this election. Americans do not agree on a lot, but they support ending cannabis prohibition, and Americans are deeply distrustful of their government and want the government to get out of the way. But we'll see how it all works out in this present day and age of politics.
John, what are your thoughts on this?
Yes, so a couple of things. Everything that Erica said, I think that his analysis is spot on. And just to kind of pause on the idea that South Dakota went straight to rec legalization. You know, I think it would have been one thing if that happened in a deeply blue state. But the idea that the first state that has gone straight to rec is South Dakota, I think is a huge symbolic development in terms of our understanding of where the American society is on this issue. And so while as a market, South Dakota may not necessarily be a market of kind of immensely consequential financial return, it's going to be a small market for sure. What it represents symbolically, I think, is hard to overstate in terms of where we are progressing as a country on this issue. Second, you know, striking when I speaks to the idea that local officials have been strongly opposed to this development. The fact that, you know, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem came out shortly after the election and basically said the voters made the wrong decision. That's a striking kind of and a strongly oppositional position to what she is now being mandated to do, which is kind of implement and execute a regulated market in a state. So I think it portends the sort of contentiousness that this process, I think, will be in South Dakota. But to Eric's point, it is a question of when, not if. It's going to be messy. It's likely going to be a bruising process. But at least two things are now clear for South Dakota's cannabis consuming or prospective cannabis consuming patients and adults. One, that they're no longer going to face prosecution once the law takes effect. And two, that it may take a little while and may be messy, but you know, it will get done. And just kind of referencing the fact that, you know, South Dakota happened before New York, John Fetterman, the Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania, in his op-ed yesterday, one of the things he said, you know, if as a Democratic state, you're on the right of South Dakota on any issue, then you need to reassess your position on that issue. And I think that's true. I think one of the things that the South Dakota initiative, even more so than Montana, has done is really been a wake-up call to legislators and governors of blue states to realize that, you know, if it can pass comfortably in South Dakota, then it's really hard to explain why this issue has not moved more progressively in the states that they are governing. So I think it is part of the reason why you saw places like Virginia come out so quickly after the November election results were released, stating that, you know, Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia, has now said he's about to initiate a two-year process to legalize in Virginia, working with the legislature. So small market, and it's going to take a little while, but the impact, the symbolic impact of the passage in South Dakota, I don't think it can or should be overstated.
Absolutely. I know when we had Melissa Mentel from the, she was a campaign manager in South Dakota. She was on one of our previous episodes, and she had come out and said, when they came out and said, we made the wrong decision, or our voters made the wrong decision, she was like, it's incredibly condescending. And on top of it, I think that they had some of the strictest penalties for anybody that consumed marijuana, even if you consumed it out of state and came back to the state. I mean, it's incredible. So I think that's going to be a major change in their state, even if it is a smaller state, and not so much of a big effect. Eric, before we wrap up and move on to the next article, what markets are you most interested in watching?
Well, certainly New Jersey and certainly Arizona. And you refer to the article, and I know the article said, well, Arizona is not as interesting because so many of these licenses only go to those who are already there, but it doesn't really work that way. I mean, there's lots of ways to get into a state. There are lots of acquisitions that can be done. So it remains a very interesting state. New Mexico is already well on their way digging into legalization just to get it done through their last session. But Arizona will force the hand of New Mexico as well. But how these states get to the point of full legalization, get to their programs up and running, will be interesting. And I certainly will keep a close eye on both of those states. While not as large a state, I think it's interesting to acknowledge Montana, and we haven't spoken about it, but it is a sort of becoming an unexpected adult use market. And that again has implications. I mean, we spoke about Montana and spoke about South Dakota. Now you have Wyoming looking at doing something, taking a step forward. So really key markets. I will keep a close eye on Illinois. It is a market that is in transition. There is a tremendous amount of activity there, both in terms of growth of the market, outstanding applications and ensuing litigation, and M&A activity. And it is, it's simultaneously being held out as an amazing success story and a disaster at the same time. So quite frankly, there's a lot to dig in there and understand what's happening in the state, how the decisions that were made interact with how the industry and the emerging market emerges, and what we can learn for other states. So certainly Illinois, it's hard to do anything in cannabis and not consider California. And California obviously has such tremendous amount of promise. It is an enormous market, and it's done cannabis for a very long time. Yet it's a troubled market. It's really had trouble kind of getting beating back the black market, the illegal market, and getting everyone licensed and getting everyone to switch more to the regulated market. So I think it's going to be a very interesting year there to see how policy unfolds and revenues unfold and how things move. And I mentioned before, I'm going to keep a close eye on New Mexico. I think it's a very interesting state, and I think they're headed toward legalization. great climate for growing. So I think they'll be growing in various different ways. And they have some good folks involved there who are mindful of how to grow the program. So that as well. Honestly, the truthful answer is all of them. Yeah, I'm going to stop there. But the truthful answer is pretty much all of them.
Exactly. Well, there's a lot going on. So it's an exciting time, I think.
It's amazing, yeah.
If well, I could, one, yes, one place that I think is has come back on my radar is one which we're actually going to be watching much more closely, to Eric's point, is California. You know, we have watched the challenges that the state has had from the outset of this program. The regulatory process was really messy. The first 6 months in particular painted a fairly grim outlook for what the state was going to be enduring as we're trying to roll this out. But we've been really struck. The state has now twice revised upward significantly the tax revenues that it has generated from the adult use market, with the latest update happening about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And one of the things that you know, my takeaway from this is, you know, for a fairly grim picture that even I had painted for, and I'll concede this as John, not New Frontier, but I had a pretty dim outlook for how long it would take California for California's regulated market to really start to encroach and challenge the unregulated one. But if these revised tax revenues are any indication, this market is actually gaining momentum more quickly than we had anticipated. And it has us wondering whether COVID, the dynamics introduced by COVID, have helped goose the transition from the unregulated market to the legal one. But I say that to suggest that 2021, I think, will be a really telling market, telling year for how the California market is going to perform. And I am now reassessing whether, even though it faced some major challenges and a couple of stumbles out the gate very early on, whether it has made up more ground more quickly than many of us had anticipated. And 2021, I think, will be the year kind of tells us whether it is going to be a long and painful path to growth, or whether we are seeing this accelerating momentum and accelerating transition of consumers out of the unregulated market into the legal one.
Amazing. Thank you for that. Well, there's another state, Eric. Put that on your radar. Well, we had touched on this a little bit already, but Politico recently reported why the next Congress is unlikely to legalize marijuana. So while things are cooking on all these new emerging markets, the national outlook is a little bit less rosy. And regardless of how the runoff elections in Georgia go, it seems like there'll be significant hurdles for federally legal cannabis in 2021. A recent Gallup poll found that 68% of Americans favor having legal access to cannabis. And post-election, a majority of Americans live in states that have approved medical or recreational cannabis. So Eric, we touched on this a little bit, but I'd like to go a little deeper. Where's the roadblock, though? What are we? Why are we hitting this roadblock in Congress?
His name's Mitch McConnell, and he controls the agenda in the Senate, and he has no interest in legalizing cannabis, and it's just that simple. He's not alone. I mean, there are others. Yeah. But I think if you actually dug in and polled people, the numbers would be much better than articles and others would indicate. But I think he controls the agenda, and he recognizes that right now this is still a Democrats issue. I mean, it's bipartisan, and we can sit and argue for the rest of the afternoon on the results from these deeply conservative and red states and look at all the numbers, but it is perceived still as a Democrats issue. And Senator McConnell is not in the business of giving any victories to Democrats. It's just that simple. It's not, you know, and he doesn't like cannabis. He's an old timer. So really, I mean, despite the polling numbers, which show really broad support across the demographics, other than those who are old and identify as deeply religious. So the support is there. I mean, the Gallup poll is very strong. It shows where we are, but it obviously does not align with the politicians that are controlling the agenda, because it's a little bit more complicated than that. They don't want to give any sort of a victory to the other side. But I will say this has evolved over years, right? I mean, you look at the demographics that have come over to legalization, and 40 years ago, it was only, you know, folks who were considered crazy hippies. And then it was progressives, and then Democrats, and then libertarians, and then government conservatives. And we see religious folks starting to come over a little bit, although not in all areas. Catholic Church is still very much against cannabis. So we'll see this, but I think that is in large part is just the raw politics of this, as opposed to those polling numbers that prevent this from happening in Congress. That said, I just want to add one more point, Heather, which is I do think it's a difficult political situation when you have the Republican Party controlling the Senate. But I've been involved in this industry for, you know, now coming on 13 years doing this work. And when I started, people told me I was out of my mind. There was no way that Illinois was going to legalize medical cannabis. And so these things change over time, and it requires a little bit of patience as well.
Yeah, I would think that the state of the economy right now with, you know, these massive lockdowns, that some things would maybe shift just for the better of the country, you know, maybe opinions would be changed a little bit. John, what's your take on that?
So, you know, I agree with Eric's assessment. Despite how bipartisan support has become amongst the public, you know, I think the political class is a lagging indicator. And one of the challenges that cannabis has, even though for many patients it may be this is a life or death issue, broadly speaking, particularly within the political class, this is viewed as a very discretionary issue. You know, the idea of quote unquote recreational cannabis, I think that even that name, I think has led some to believe that this really is, it's not a high priority and it's a winning issue for Democrats. So why support it? A couple of things that I think will lead to this kind of gradual shift that we are seeing. It's going to happen more slowly in Congress, but it's happening across the country. One is the idea of medical cannabis becoming a kitchen table issue. Much like gay marriage, you know, once you had a family friend, a family member, you know, grandmama start using medical cannabis and see acute benefit from it, that goes a really long way in eroding opposition. Second, we've had a really robust debate as a country, or discussion as a country around policing, criminal justice reform. And I think for a lot of people, it was the first time that they really started to get a clear sense of just how kind of punitive policing can be, particularly once you introduce cannabis as a factor in interceptions and arrests. So there's kind of a convergence of factors that are leading people to think differently about this. And then finally, around just the economics and the business of cannabis. The idea that because of the way cannabis is regulated in our society, you know, getting access to banking remains a challenge for a lot of these businesses. Taxing ends up being really punitive. Because a majority of Americans now live in jurisdictions where it is legal, whether they like it or not, a lot more legislators are representing businesses, stakeholders who are being impacted by these misalignments between federal law and state law. And, you know, taking together, like any one of these may not necessarily be enough to trip the switch, but taken collectively, whether it is those who are looking to ensure that kind of our financial markets and the business environment is operating smoothly, whereas those who are looking to address the kind of inefficiencies or inequities in our criminal justice system, or whether it is those who are looking at the health side of things and recognizing that there's not only very strong therapeutic value in cannabis, but one that on a cost basis is dramatically lower than kind of conventional pharmaceutical healthcare. These give stakeholders different points of intersection by which to reconsider their views on this. With Mitch McConnell standing as the Senate Majority Leader, it's likely dead in the water. So the outcome of the Georgia election, I think, is going to be really critical here in terms of what happens over the next 4 years and when developments happen over the next 4 years. But it's as long as it is viewed as one, discretionary, and two, as a democratic issue, then I think, you know, corralling the Republicans to support sweeping federal reform will be immensely challenging.
Well, this article actually mentions the passing of the Safe Banking Act last year, and then more recently, the MORE Act just passed in the House, largely along party lines, right? And then it's headed to the Senate where it faces its challenges. From a policy perspective, Eric, I'll start with you. What do you think the consequences of delaying these initiatives? Because it looks like there's no chance of it passing in the Senate.
Well, there are many ramifications of delay. Many in the industry, by the way, don't want a full legalization bill passed, you know, next year. They want more time to build up their businesses. It's a difficult situation, but it's a difficult situation they know, and they can operate with a limited capital and are making it work. So it's not like everyone wants that. And so the delay has all sorts of business ramifications that are important. But on the public policy side, this sort of delay, and I want to be clear on it, it just allows the illicit market to remain entrenched. These folks who think we don't want cannabis, it's a fool's errand. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. So all they're doing is allowing the illicit market to thrive, really. And to then suggest that the solution is turnkey and you legalize and you tax at 25% of whatever, it doesn't work that way. So people have to understand that this market exists. And the effort here is to bring folks within the rule of law and to bring the rule of law into an industry. So I think that the delay allows the illicit market to become more entrenched, which it really is. I mean, I think I went to a hockey game back when we could actually go out to things right as the Illinois market was opening. And I listened to a conversation of the guys behind me and they said, "Have you been to one of those dispensaries yet?" "No, not yet. I'm still buying for my guy." This is the conversation. And the interest was just to go check out the dispensary. It wasn't like, "I feel compelled, I'm going to buy there." It was like, "It's more expensive and I'd be interested to check it out." But it wasn't like the draw for those folks. And our government has to recognize that and has to recognize the harms that arise from the illicit market and the relative benefits that arise from the regulated market move there. And the delays are just feeding into that and not accomplishing what these politicians think that they are accomplishing. That said, there are some truly legal impediments for moving the country to full legalization. And the recent rescheduling by WHO and the WHO and the UN should help our federal government as well. But as we pointed out, those aren't the real impediments. Now, the real impediments are the Republicans standing in the way. And then the next biggest impediment is we can sit and talk about legalization and the need to get it done. But as I said earlier, how do you get it done? I guarantee you, Heather, that John and I could spend the rest of the afternoon just talking about tax policy. Mm-hmm. And tax policy impacts all of this. And then you talk about interstate commerce. Well, what's the impact of interstate commerce on the social equity programs that the states have set up? These are very challenging issues. And we don't even have, it's not like we have any consensus on the overall solution. So I think this is going to take time. And sometimes things just take time. And it's in, and when you think of things in millennia, it's not a big deal. I understand everyone's impatient. I am. No one's more impatient than I am. But I think it's a matter of getting the right people in place and getting the right policies in place and moving forward on that.
Yeah, we've had a couple of conversations about a lot of these, you know, smaller businesses wanting to build up and have the chance to before these huge conglomerates come in from Canada or just, you know, bigger companies that are in the mainstream consumer goods. John, what's your take on this?
You know, to Eric's point, considering even the people who strongly support this don't agree on how it should get done. When you add to that the people who don't support it being forced to participate in decision-making process or a regulatory and policy-making process means that it is going to be really, really messy. And, you know, so the failure to do this now obviously means that the illicit market continues to become more entrenched, to Eric's point. And critically, at a time that our both national and kind of state municipal finances are completely off kilter because of COVID, it means that there's a lot of money that these governments are leaving on the table or are not capturing that we know is being spent, and particularly and being spent at an increasingly kind of elevated rate because of the pandemic. That's a significant missed opportunity for the jurisdictions that, that remain unregulated. But maybe trying to find a silver lining here, if there's some utility in the evolution toward federal legalization or national kind of legalization framework taking a little time, maybe it is that it gives us a little more time to better understand which approach to market regulation seems to be most effective over the long, over the longer term, or at least over the medium term. The utility of having, in this case, 36 state experiments, 15 adult use experiments, gives us a chance to really start seeing, what seems to work well, what seems to doesn't, what seems to create kind of the most efficient and elegant transition of consumers to the legal market, what seems to create the most vibrant environment for businesses to operate. Some of this is all so new. We're talking about Illinois, Michigan as markets that are both the best of times and worst of times, but they're both also still really young markets. And maybe if we're able to get another couple of years without the added complexity of federal legalization, we will have clearer lines of sight on which operational models are most effective and start steering our national regulatory framework toward, let's call it the idealized best practice model. Because I don't think we're there yet. I just don't think we have enough operational referential examples to be able to say definitively that one type of market regulation is the best in breed.
I absolutely agree with that, John. And I think that's there's a lot of wisdom in that. I do want to say, add to that, that we're at a different point going into a Biden administration than we were if we were going into a second Trump administration. We have a president-elect who has pledged to have the government not enforce federal prohibition against the state legal programs and their participants. So that in and of itself is going to move capital in different ways than folks felt comfortable before. So there is, it's not a black and white issue, like you need this for any capital to enter the industry. Mm-hmm. So, I think we'll see continued advancement and folks feeling a lot more comfortable of the great unknown of any sort of like a crackdown. That's simply not going to happen going forward. And folks will be able to concentrate on the important parts of building out the business. But two more things. One, this is a challenge. I mean, you have parts of the Democratic Party saying, we will not vote for a legalization bill unless it contains these social equity provisions. And at the very same time, you have Mitch McConnell standing up at the lectern saying, the Democrats want to send the diversity police into your business, right? And so those things just don't meet. And that's challenging. But I want to say, despite all that, that I firmly believe that we will get a federal legalization bill. I'm not suggesting it's going to get passed this coming year, but I do think it's going to happen. I'm not here to predict whether it's next year or the year after or the year after that, but I believe that's going to happen. And I believe that's what we're working toward and what businesses ought to be working toward. What that looks like and how it takes place is there are lots of uncertainties about that. But I do think despite all the sort of grimness that we discussed, that that's where we are headed and that will have obviously enormous impacts. And these things will happen over a period of years. And that's okay. I mean, quite frankly, we're all so busy with what we're doing, it's hard to imagine this going faster. So I do think we're still looking at tremendous amounts of progress happening as we're sitting here. And sometimes that's hard to see when you're in the middle of it, when you have a goal so important as full legalization on the federal level.
Right. Well, thank you so much. And we probably could sit here and talk about this all afternoon, but we are out of time. So I want to thank you both so much for joining us today. And thank you to our listeners. Please be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast and keep a lookout for a new report released by New Frontier Data. It's Cannabis in America for 2021 and Beyond, a new normal in consumption and demand, which also includes a special update to our U.S. Cannabis Report 2021 Industry Outlook. So it has all the updates post-election. I'm your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you all next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.